From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. It's nearly spring, and that means plants will begin to peek out of the soil again, insects will return in force, and you might start to see more critters wandering around. It's all part of the circle of life.
So who is the weaker species? Ants don't serve grasshoppers. It's you who need us.
Today, we'll focus on Georgia's wildlife. From the bushy-tailed variety that climb our trees to the ancient shelled kind that swim off our shores. But we definitely want to hear your stories about encounters with wildlife. Have you ever had a scary or funny interaction with a critter of some kind? Tell us a story. Call 404-500-9457, tweet us at OST Talk, or email, and we might feature your comments on the show. Some time ago, we talked to Atlanta City Council member Kwanzaa Hall about Atlanta's tree canopy. In short, the city's trying to figure out how many trees it has and how many it's lost. And Councilman Hall dropped this bomb on us.
There's also a squirrel census out there, so just so you know. There's also
really?
Another study on the number of squirrels that we have in town.
Squirrel census? We definitely needed to hear about that. And he is right. The first squirrel census was done for Atlanta's Inman Park neighborhood in 2012. Another was just completed in October, and the report is out now. Jamie Allen came up with the idea for the squirrel census. We spoke to him in 2015, and we were joined by Jamie's field commander for the census, Josh O'Connor. Josh worked for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and I began by asking Jamie how the squirrel census started.
It began with a short story I was working on, actually. I'm a writer, and I was working on a short story that was based on my dog's interactions with squirrels, my dog Sophie. And she actually is, you know, completely obsessed with squirrels. And so I wrote a story about a dog that's obsessed with squirrels and is convinced that they're actually going to come down and attack one day. And so to lend a sense
She's got to protect you from the squirrel menace.
She's got to protect her owner, right?
Yeah.
And then they do. And so to lend a sense of realism to the story, I was wondering if is that one squirrel per person, or is it, what is it? And so I started calling around.
Could they actually overcome humans?
Yeah.
Should they develop opposable thumbs? Right.
They're great athletes. So, and nobody even had the slightest idea, which I thought was kind of funny because we do kind of know like how many rats are around, right? We have an estimate on that. And so
we
I know
birds. Lots of people watch birds.
Yeah. There's lots of bird counts that go on. And so I just started like, you know, talking to some friends and, you know, Stuart Haddock, my best friend, I was talking to him. He's an artist. And I was like, let's count the squirrels. And he's like, yeah, man, let's do it. Yeah. Let's
really?
Do it. Yeah. Yeah. And then I talked to other people and they'd be like, why? Why would you ever
see,
want to do that?
See, that would be my response. or then, have you been drinking, Jamie?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know.
Yeah.
It depends on the evening, but yeah. And so then talking, you know, with other people, we just started like sort of spreading the word. And I remember being on the street corner one day at Buddy's at King of Pop stand, and I was talking to Stephen Karst, the King of Pops, and about squirrels. And he really was just sort of busy and running his business. And he was just like, if you want to talk about squirrels, talk to that guy. And I turned around and Josh O'Connor came riding up on his bike and said, what do you want to know about squirrels, dude? So he started calling around, and then that really set the whole thing in motion.
Okay. So Josh, I want to play you actually a clip because we followed two of the volunteers who helped with the squirrel census, Kara Mahler and Nick Nichols. And they were actually really surprised how hard it was for them to find squirrels in their particular assigned area. But here's the sound of them after 20 minutes, they finally spot a squirrel, and you can hear how excited they are.
Squirrel.
Oh my God.
It's climbing a tree.
Oh my God.
And they jumped. So it was running up a tree. It ran and jumped.
Cool.
Fantastic. Good sighting, guys.
I'm so excited to see a squirrel.
The dog is excited also. But is that surprise? I mean, is it... Can it, you go 20, 30 minutes without seeing a squirrel here?
Absolutely, and that's part of the census is, you know, we're doing the whole neighborhood, and so there's areas that aren't as good of habitat for the squirrels, and also depends on the weather and what they have locally for forage in the area. So that day, I think it was pretty overcast, and it was just kind of one of those days where we weren't having a lot of luck finding squirrels ourselves.
Jamie, how do you know you're not counting the same squirrel multiple times?
Yeah, that's aside from why, that's probably the biggest question that we get. And we actually probably do count the same squirrel twice. The way the methodology is broken down, The neighborhood is laid out into 151 hectares, 100 meter by 100 meter, and you go into one specific hectare at a certain time of day and count the squirrels that you see there. So there's a chance that the squirrel you're counting could hop over to the other hectare.
Yeah, they're fast little buggers. Counted.
Yeah, but they don't wander too far away. They're actually, they usually stay within 100 meters of their nest. And so the formula that we plug it into, it sort of flattens out these numbers and gives an average.
What does the typical Georgia squirrel look like? Because I've lived in all four corners of the country, and squirrels look different depending on where you are in the country. What does a Georgia squirrel look like?
Well, a Georgia squirrel, most of them are eastern gray squirrels, so they're on average a couple pounds maybe, and maybe a foot and a half long at tops.
Including the tail?
Yes, including the tail. But, you know, the more unique squirrels we see are typically in our neighborhood, closer to little 5 points. Some of them are a little rougher.
Yeah. They're street squirrels. Jamie,
squirrels,
how many, you counted in 2012. How many squirrels did you come up with in Inman Park?
So the squirrel abundance number that we came up with was 861 squirrels. And according to the formula that we use, that's approximately 90% accurate. So we didn't actually,
wow.
So we actually counted 825 squirrels, but then applying it to the formula, it came up with the number of 861.
Okay, so, and now you're expanding it. Mm-hmm. Where are you looking for count squirrels now?
Okay, yeah, we've expanded.
Because you can't do all of Metro Atlanta. That's
not yet. We're trying, maybe. We want to do all of North America, right? Isn't
yeah.
that, yeah. No, the world. We're going for the world. And no, before that, though. Inman Park, Candler Park, a part of Candler Park, a part of Piedmont Park, a part of Grant Park, a part of East Lake.
McCoy Park.
McCoy Park. And then, Reynoldstown. And then we're going to, we have squirrel census ambassadors at colleges on the East Coast, basically, or like on the eastern half of the U.S.
What does an ambassador do?
They represent the squirrel census at their college, and they might, you know, create a club. And then they also go out and do a count on usually in the university quad or someplace that it has a lot of squirrels around.
I thought maybe they were establishing diplomatic relations with the squirrels.
Well, that too, yeah, yeah.
Let me go back to the beginning of this census and when you started that. The first one was 2012,
mm-hmm.
And you convinced some people to help you out. You happened to meet Josh because you both like King of Pops treats.
Mm-hmm.
And how did this go from that, yeah, let's count squirrels, to actually creating a methodology and getting the number of volunteers that you needed?
Well, Josh knew a lot about, counting squirrels and knew about methodologies for counting wildlife. And then we also got Donald Bisanzio, who was a professor at Emory University, and he studied squirrels, and mm-hmm. He and Josh worked a little further on creating the methodology. And Alyssa Martello, who's a vet and is now Donald's wife, they came together. And then we also found, through playing ping pong, Nat Slaughter, who was a graphic design infographic guy. And he's the guy that helped take the numbers that we collected and the stories that we collected and then present them in an entertaining way and really a beautiful way.
Okay, so let me take this to you, Josh, because you're the guy with the Fish and Wildlife Service, right? And you want to count all the squirrels everywhere. Why? What do you do with this information?
Well, I think the information could be important to a lot of people, but the main goal, I think, of the census is to get folks out of their houses, get to meet their neighbors, go get to see their neighborhood, and get connected with wildlife. I think it's a good goal to have folks who may or may not have a reason to go see their neighborhood all of a sudden tie it into that fuzzy little gray thing running around and get to go see their neighborhood.
Does that fuzzy little gray thing serve a purpose ecologically? I mean, if all squirrels disappeared from Metro Atlanta, would it impact us?
Oh, yeah. You could ask your tree canopy folks. But, you know, the gray squirrel helps plant a lot of acorns, and they create oak trees and they create forests. So the eastern gray squirrel does a really good job of hiding its nuts, sometimes so good that it creates a new tree.
Because my dog would like to see them all gone. I assume that your dog has the same attitude, Jamie.
I'm not quite convinced, actually. She happened upon a child squirrel when she was pretty young and didn't know what to do with it. And I think she's been certain, in my mind, the fiction I create is that she's been searching for that squirrel ever since.
Okay, so if somebody wants to volunteer to help count squirrels, Jamie, where do they go?
You can go to squirrelcensus.com or email us at volunteers@squirrelcensus.com.
That was Jamie Allen with the Squirrel Census in Atlanta. We also heard from Josh O'Connor of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Now, Georgia squirrels have plenty of flying friends. The state's home to nearly 350 species of birds. That includes the cardinal, the mockingbird, and the brown thrasher. Each species has a unique voice, but it takes a very well-trained ear to tell them apart. Last spring, producer Sean Powers met up with some local bird watchers to learn about the variety of chirps, tweets, and calls that can be heard throughout the state.
My name is Vinod Babu. I'm a postdoctoral researcher in Georgia Tech, and I'm one of the co-leaders of this walk today.
Hi, I'm Ralph Smith. I'm with the Atlanta Audubon Society, and I wanted to, you know, welcome along with Vinod, welcome you here this morning.
We have some robins on the barn. We are actually hearing an eastern towhee sing now.
A lot of bird songs have, we make mnemonic sayings for them to help us remember their songs, and the one for the towhee is drink your tea, and it's drink your tea.
I'm with GPB, Georgia Public Broadcasting, NPR affiliate. So, question, did you know birds can sing?
No, I didn't know at all.
Really?
Yeah.
Does it sound like singing to you?
Yes, it really does. And it sounds beautiful, of course, because it's nature. My name is Ariana Tyson. I go to Georgia Cyber Academy, and I do dual enrollment at Gwinnett Technical College. Bird singing is their way of being themselves, because each type of bird has their own specific sound. And me, a lot of the times there aren't females that are into, you know, technology and the things that I'm into, and that's the way that I express myself. You know, I express myself with, you know, the coding that I do. And these birds, they express themselves with the way that they sing and the way that they fly.
Okay, so how many different birds are singing right now that we can hear?
It feels like we're all around them.
I think I'm hearing five or so. That's the towhee, cardinal. I heard a song sparrow there. The brown-headed cowbird is singing, and the house finch. Wow.
My name is Sanji Henderson, internal auditor at Norfolk Southern.
Well, what do you think so far of what you've seen?
It's beautiful. It's hard for me to distinguish which birds are saying.
I know. I don't know how they're able to do it. I probably am tone deaf, but I don't know how they're able to tell like which song is which. I don't get it. It all sounds the same to me.
It doesn't sound the same, but it's hard to pinpoint.
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah. Where are we right now?
We're in the forest, in Fernbank Forest.
Okay.
And we can see some of the restoration work that's being done back there.
Were we going to see the thrasher?
We might see one, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Cool. It was like 2,000 songs, I think.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's the brown thrasher, which hopefully we'll see. It's one of the most prolific singers. It's got the widest repertoire of any bird in North America, and it's Georgia State bird.
Yeah. Well, I hope it can copyright some of those songs.
Well, no, it's actually mimicking other birds' songs, so if anything, the other birds should copyright it.
Or sue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That story was produced by GPB's Sean Powers. As part of the upcoming Atlanta Science Festival, the Atlanta Audubon Society is hosting a bird watch on Saturday at Fernbank Forest in Atlanta. It starts at 9 a.m. Coming up, what kind of furry beasts live in Atlanta anyway? But first, could some animals be smarter than humans? This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have you ever bragged about how smart your dog is, the pride you feel about how intelligent they can be, or how the cat always seems to know when you're a little bit down in the dumps and tries to cheer you up, maybe? Animal intelligence fascinates us, and biologists have been studying it for years, but primatologist Franz de Waals says asking if animals are as smart as we are is really the wrong question. Franz de Waals is the director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. He's also a professor at Emory University, and his book is called Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? Franz de Waals, welcome.
Yeah, I'm glad to be there.
I have to admit, this book is fascinating. You almost can't put it down. And we can't go through everything point by point, but I wanted to start with this idea of this question of comparison. Because it looks as though we have, for a long time, judged animals' intellect based on whether they can accomplish things humans can. Is that accurate?
Yeah, we are very focused, of course, on language and reading and writing and technology. And we are very strong in that. And so we have tried to judge animals on those terms. And that works okay with, let's say, a chimpanzee who is very similar to us and has very similar skills. But there are species, you know, like, let's say, the octopus or the elephant or certain birds that are very smart but are very different from us and have a very different lifestyle. And why would we make that comparison? Is that really interesting to know, are you smarter than an octopus? Well, in your environment, with what you daily do, you are obviously very smart. But in the octopus's environment, who knows how you would be faring? We don't know.
And what a continuing theme throughout the book is this idea of crafting a useful experiment. One of the questions we've often asked is how well do animals use tools? That's been a measure of intelligence in the past. But you talk about one in which they didn't take into account the animal's biology, the structure of the animal's body when they were crafting the experiment. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so for example, with the elephant, they tested elephants on mirrors to see if they recognize themselves in mirrors, but they used a very small mirror, and an elephant probably only sees a whole lot of gray moving around in a small mirror. And they tested tool use in elephants by giving them a stick and putting food outside of their cage and see what they would do. And any primate will pick up the stick and get the food closer and then eat it, of course. But the elephant was not doing anything. And they had concluded that that means elephants are not tool users. But elephants have a trunk, and the trunk is not just a grasping organ, but it's also a smelling organ. And it turns out the elephant doesn't want to close off that organ when he reaches for food. And so when they gave elephants boxes to stand on, even boxes that were far away that he had to bring all the way from another part of the enclosure to the place where they had hung some food very high, he would do that. And so he was able to use tools, but not the way we wanted them, so to speak. And that's always a problem with testing of animals. If you don't find something, what does that mean? Does that mean that it lacks a capacity, or does it mean that we did not do the right test on them?
So there's also a really fascinating section on testing of mice. And mice are such common lab animals. They were testing to see if mice could conceal the fact that they were in pain. How did that experiment work?
Well, there's several pain experiments. One on mice was on what we call empathy. So there's now increasingly studies on rodents and empathy. And the mouse study was to see if they exhibited pain and if that stimulated the pain sensitivity of other mice. So that was what they call pain contagion. And recently at Emory, we did a study on voles. Voles are also little rodents. And we did a neuroscience study on empathy and found that the neural circuitry, basically, the way empathy works in the rodent is exactly the same it works in the human. And so this is a very old system that you also have in your average dog. Your dog is empathic. Your dog responds to your emotions. And that's actually why we have dogs and cats in the house rather than snakes and lizards usually, because mammals have that capacity and we like that in them.
So then there was another point at which scientists threw a t-shirt that smelled of humans into the cage with the mice, and they were really afraid. And I wondered, does that mean that every experiment related to mice is in some way possibly flawed because there are humans present?
Well, what they found actually is that mice perform better with female experimenters than male experimenters. And that mice are apparently a little bit stressed if they smell that there's a man around. And that may be true for other animals as well. We know it now for mice. Who knows? It may be true for other animals. And so that means that if you have experimenters of two genders, you have to watch which gender is doing the testing. And so this all relates to methodology. We in science, of course, the scientists, we are very keen on good methodology, and we need to pay attention to that. But people don't always realize that these small details, because it seems like a small detail, matter a lot for the animals.
And it also, in terms of methodology, makes it difficult to test these things in a lab, right? As opposed to going out into the field and watching gorillas in their own natural habitat, which is something that's been discussed long before. It makes it difficult to create a lab experiment that really shows us the natural behavior of an animal.
Yeah, that's why it's very important to always combine the two. So I do, of course, my experiments, I do them in Lawrenceville here at the Yerkes Field Station. And those are captive chimpanzees that live outdoors, but we call them indoors for the experiment, basically. That's how it works. But we always need to combine that knowledge with what we know from the field. So what do chimpanzees and bonobos do in the field? How does it relate to what we observe in captivity? You need to put the two pieces of the puzzle together to get a full picture. So, for example, we do experiments on cooperation. Now, cooperation is, we set up an apparatus on which two chimps have to pull to get their food and see how good they are to cooperate in that regard. But we need to connect that with what chimps do in the field. In the field, for example, chimpanzees cooperate to hunt monkeys. Monkeys are smaller than chimpanzees, and they live high up in the trees. They're very hard to catch, obviously. And so chimps need to cooperate. They need to surround them, and they need to have a task division to do that. And so we can compare what we find in captivity with what being observed in the field, and that gives us a sort of the complete picture.
So, you know, there are tests in which we have thought we found intelligence in a non-human animal. And I'm thinking particularly of, there was one African gray parrot who became the first non-human animal to ask an existential question. And that question was, what color am I? Does a test like that and a finding like that actually reveal intelligence on the part of that gray parrot?
Well, Alex the parrot is definitely very intelligent. Alex the parrot can count up things even. So they can show Alex, well, Alex died a couple of years ago. Yeah. I'm sorry to say that. But they could show Alex a few small items, like little pieces of pasta, for example, and put a cup over them. So you show him three pieces, you put a cup over it. You show him two more pieces, you put a cup over it. And then you say, how many pieces? And he says five. So he cannot even look at the pieces anymore because they're covered. But he has he remembers them and he can count them up. And this was a capacity that everyone said cannot be done with language, without language. And so that humans, there's always this thinking that humans solve all these problems with language. But actually, language is probably not nearly as important as we think in our thinking process. And Alex could do things that everyone had claimed to, so categorization of things, like the existential question that you gave here. And he doesn't have language the way we have. Of course, he can label things, and that's why he can call out certain names and certain numbers. But he doesn't have language the way we do.
If you're just joining us, my guest is primatologist Frans de Waal. His new book is called Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? Language becomes a big point in your book as well, because there are animals who have learned to maybe mimic human sounds. Maybe they're not actually understanding language the way human language. I'm thinking of a gorilla learning sign language, for example, and how we compare that, if it's even possible or viable to compare that to, say, the language that another animal might use to warn of a predator coming or things like that. Mm-hmm. Can we compare the languages?
Well, the thing is that language is the one capacity in my whole book where I say that's probably special for humans. We've tried to teach it to animals, and we've tried to find it in their natural communication. But a symbolic system that is flexible like our language, I don't think we have found that. Now, that doesn't mean that animals don't have communication, and sometimes very complex communication. So, for example, chimpanzees and bonobos, they have facial expressions very similar to our facial expressions. They have hand gestures. But there are animals like, let's say, the killer whales and the dolphins that have underwater sounds that are very complex. And so the natural communication system of the animals is actually where we should be looking, I think, rather than trying to impose our communication, which is language, on them and see how far they get. I think it would be much, much more productive to look at what they can do naturally. And it's very complex what they do. So, for example, recently there was a study on alarm calls by chimpanzees, and they had put some artificial snake in the grass to see what they would do with it. And they found that the chimpanzees would only give the alarm calls to other chimps if the other chimps did not know about the snake. So they took into account what the others know or don't know about the snake. And that is called theory of mind. And that's another capacity that for the longest time we thought was uniquely human, but now it has been found in wild chimpanzees.
So what about, say, the language of prairie dogs, which, you know, this is a very simple animal, and I imagine most people don't think of prairie dogs as being particularly intelligent as compared to a dolphin, and yet their language is extremely specific.
Yeah, well, we usually wouldn't call it language. That's a sort of colloquialism, so we call it usually communication. And they have what we call referential communication, just like some monkeys do, where they have specific calls for specific predators. So they don't only communicate to each other, watch out, there's danger, but they also tell you what danger is out there. So it is actually quite complex. And we're discovering all these things in the last 25 years. We're discovering so many new things that we did not know about animals. And my book is partly about how it came about that we are discovering all these things now. And I think it is because in the previous century, we have simplified animals far too much. We tested them mostly in little boxes, you know, the so-called Skinner boxes for rats and pigeons. So we worked with small-brained animals in small boxes. And it is much more productive to set up complex experiments where they can show their full-blown potential. And that's what we're doing at the moment.
It also feels as though one of the things that has had to happen in order to move this research forward is for us our scientists to let go of sort of arrogant assumptions. And that brings me to the chimp Ayumu, to look at a chimp that is capable of much more than we are and think, well, maybe he is smarter if we're using a different scale.
Yeah. Yeah. So Ayumu can tap numbers on a touchscreen. From 1 to 9 or from 9 to 1. But the trick is, of course, the interesting part is that the numbers disappear within a few milliseconds. So you get barely, if you as a human look at the screen, you barely see the numbers and they disappear. And he has to tap the locations where the numbers used to be in the right order. And he does that. So he has a sort of flash memory that is better than human memory. As soon as this was found, people got very upset that this chimp was better than humans. And so some American scientists, they went into training to see if they could beat the chimpanzee. And they actually, they got quite far, but not far enough. And Ayumu keeps beating everyone. And I don't know why people are so upset about it, because that relates, of course, to the idea that we need to be on top with everything, every capacity. But there are so many capacities in the animal kingdom that we don't relate to at all. So, for example, a bat can catch prey in the dark, which it does with echolocation. We cannot do that. It takes an enormous amount of brain power to do this, to calculate the path of the prey and your own speed. And it's a very complex task, but we usually don't look at it because it doesn't relate to anything that we do. And so we think, well, that's probably an instinct or something. We try to downplay what the bat is doing, which is really remarkable. And this happens all the time. As soon as we are beaten by an animal, we try to beat it back, and we try to show that we are better. And if animals have capacities that are very different from ours, we sort of forget about it and we're not particularly interested in it.
So if in the past we have thought of intelligence as a ranking, kind of like the food chain where we're on the top, and if that's incorrect, then what's a better way of thinking of animal intelligence?
Well, instead of a tree or a ladder, what we have is a bush with many branches. That's the evolutionary bush, and many of these branches are specializations. And we have one specialization. We are very good at language and abstraction and technology. So we have several specializations, and then you have other animals. They have their specializations, and so each of these branches. So for example, you can find in the primate branch, you can find animals who use tools, such as ourselves or chimpanzees and so on. But you find them also in the crows. The crows are birds. It's quite a separate branch from ours, but the crows are very good tool users, and they are being tested massively at the moment in laboratories. And so you have to look at it not as a ladder, like it goes from high to low. That's what people usually do. Who is the smartest of them all? And it has to be us, of course. But more like a bush with a lot of specializations.
So we have about a minute left. Can you answer the title of your book? Are we smart enough to know how smart animals are?
Well, I'm an optimist. I think we are smart enough for the task, and we are working very hard on it. But of course, the answer is that in the previous century, we didn't show that kind of intelligence. We tested animals in very simplistic ways, and we had very simplistic views about how they were instinctive or simple learners. We didn't really appreciate the intelligence of animals.
So the answer has been no, we weren't smart enough, but it's possible that we are.
Yeah, yeah, the new generation, I think, is, yeah.
Frans de Waal is the director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. He also teaches at Emory University. His new book is called Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? And I guess the answer is maybe. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Okay, thank you.
Coming up, the outdoor zoo that is Atlanta, Georgia. But first, CSI for sea turtles. This is On Second Thought. Looking far under the sea, under the sea. Darling, it's better down where it's wetter. Take it from me. Up on the shore, they work all day. Out in the sun, they slave away. While the deep boating full time, floating under the sea. As off through the waves they roll. The fish on the land ain't happy. It's hard cause they in the bowl. But fish in the bowl is lucky. They in for a worse fate. One day when the boss get hungry. Yes, you go beyond the place. But no, under the sea. Under the sea. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Tomorrow we'll talk about some of the dangers of cosmetic products used by black women. A new study from an environmental research and consumer advocacy group finds a large number of these products contain harmful ingredients. We'll talk about this and explore the history of cosmetics. Have you ever had a bad experience with a skin or hair product? Call us and tell us the story. It's 404-500-9457. And then be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for that discussion. If we don't do anything, sea turtles could disappear from the Earth within a few decades. And that would be bad, bad news for the oceans. But researchers at the University of Georgia think they've developed an innovative way to help save these turtles. We talked to Joe Nairn about it in 2015. He's a conservation genetics professor at the University of Georgia's Warnell School of Forestry and Natural Resources. He began by explaining to me why this research is important for the state.
Georgia has a very unique population. Florida has a lot more turtles than we have. But this is a valuable resource for our state, and I think that a lot of the people in the state of Georgia recognize that.
Are we talking about the leatherback sea turtles?
We are talking predominantly about loggerhead sea turtles in Georgia. Leatherbacks, we get a nest or two this far north, but leatherbacks and greens tend to be more tropical and loggerheads are more temperate. So the bulk of our population is loggerhead turtles.
So how big, what does a loggerhead then look like? I mean, leatherbacks can get huge. What does a loggerhead look like?
Well, they don't get quite as big as the leatherback, but they get quite huge themselves. They're quite long-lived species, and by the time they're reproductively mature, which takes about 25 or 30 years from the time they hatch, they're pretty large individuals.
Okay, so first of all, can we kind of get a context on how endangered these turtles are? I know that some scientists have said if we don't do something, this species that has been around for more than 100 million years will disappear soon. What does soon mean? How endangered are they?
Well, I think that that's true. If we didn't change how we've been treating these animals over the years, but that has begun to change. We don't harvest them commercially like we did up through the early 1900s. But yes, if we continued the kind of take that we have on these populations, I could understand why people would project that we could lose them within a few decades.
Okay, so the specific project that your team is working on is a way to track sea turtles' DNA. Explain how that works.
What we do is we're actually using DNA as a way to tag turtles to monitor populations. Instead of putting a flipper tag on them, what we do is take a sample and we do a DNA fingerprint, much like we use for human identity. If you look at enough markers in the DNA of an individual, you can identify that individual. You can also use that kind of technology to identify relatedness, parent offsprings. We use it in paternity cases in the human population, and we can do the same thing with turtles now.
So how is that? I assume you also tag them so you can figure out where they are in the world?
We do still have beaches that tag and that do physical tagging. Jekyll Island still does physical tagging in the state. Wausau, Not many beaches compared to the whole coast actually do physical tagging. And there are also a number of efforts to put satellite transmitters on turtles where they can track them essentially all over an ocean basin for a year or so.
But biologists are really excited about this DNA tracking. Help me make the connection. How does understanding each individual turtle's DNA help you protect them?
Well, I think that the biggest advantage of our approach is that we can do this on very large spatial scales. If you look at the physical tagging projects, you can only cover a beach or an island. There's a limit to how much territory you can cover. You have to have people out on the beach all night. The turtles are only out of the water for an hour or so. So you have to physically intercept these turtles. The thing that really made this a breakthrough for us was that not only did we develop the DNA tracking technology or the marker technology to fingerprint the turtles, but we found a way that we could get the mother's DNA out of the eggshell. So now instead of having to intercept turtles, which would be limited to a small percentage of the total population, we can sample virtually every turtle that nests in Georgia now because we have a large nest monitoring network in Georgia. And they go out and they identify in the morning each nest that was laid at night, and we can collect samples from each nest and then assign those nests to the individual female. And females lay several nests throughout the nesting season.
How many turtle eggs are in each nest?
About 100 in each nest. And our turtles lay several nests a year, but they only nest every few years. So they don't come back every year to nest.
Okay, so I you guys then have a DNA map. You can sort of follow this DNA line throughout the world. And then how does that then help protect the animals?
Well, one of the things it does is it gives us information to base conservation decisions on. It allowing us to, for example, tell how many female turtles we have left in the population. We're beginning to look at whether that population's growing or whether that population's stable or declining. And it allows us to do this for a whole population because not only are we doing this in Georgia, we're doing every sea turtle nest that's laid north of the Florida border. So we're doing what we call the Northern Recovery Unit, which is a unique population that nests in Georgia, South Carolina, and North Carolina.
Okay, so I am not a conservation genetics professor, so help me out here, Joe. I have a DNA map of these turtles, especially the females, and that helps me know which ones are productive, which females are mating and breeding and then laying lots of eggs. And then that means I can go and protect those beaches in particular and focus on the places where there's actually babies being born. Is that
accurate? That's absolutely correct. It gives us better information about how to apply management and conservation approaches for this population.
Okay, and let me just address the importance of why we need to do this, because this is an all-out sort of effort to protect these, not just loggerheads, but sea turtles in general. And I want to make it clear why we do that other than just sort of charitable reasons. What purpose do sea turtles serve in the ecology of the ocean and the overall health?
Well, I think some people would suggest that turtles are kind of an indicator of ocean health, and that can sometimes be a difficult thing to ascertain. What we do know is that healthy turtle populations are going to reflect a healthy ocean, and vice versa. If we have a healthy ocean, if we have good, sound conservation practices in place, then we'll protect both the turtles and the habitat that they live in. That habitat benefits many other species as well.
So there's other things that have to change. So you get the DNA evidence from a particular female. You know that she's healthy, she's laying a lot of eggs, and then somebody gets deployed, or volunteers, or someone else gets deployed to the beach that she likes, and they make sure that the eggs or the hatchlings make it all to the way to the ocean. They shoo away seagulls and things. Is that where this ends up?
Well, we do have nest protection efforts in place. We have people that monitor these beaches. In many cases, they put screens over the nest so that predators can't dig up the nests and eat the eggs. We're increasing our ability to produce more hatchling turtles, or to have more hatchling turtles survive. For example, because of coastal erosion, Many times, nests need to be moved a little bit higher on the beach so that they're not washed over by the waves.
To what extent, Joe, is this a race against time? I read one estimate that the turtle sea turtle populations in general have been decimated by somewhere between 80 and 95%. So can these conservation efforts beat the race to extinction?
We certainly hope so, and that's the assumption that we're operating under. As long as we can, first of all, stop the decline in the populations and stabilize it, and then manage our habitat and our oceans and our beach habitat for nesting so that the population can start to grow and kind of replenish what we've lost.
And fishing. I mean, you have to change people's entire countries and fishing villages' method of fishing. I read one place in which they use something called long lining. You probably know what this is. And fishing vessels will lay out a 60-mile line of hanging baited hooks, sometimes 3,000 hooks at a time. That's not something a sea turtle can get past.
Well, and that's absolutely true. And we lose tens of thousands of turtles every year as bycatch in the long line fishing industry. And that's one of the problems for these turtles is they're threatened by coastal they're threatened in every part of their habitat. Coastal development threatens them. Beach erosion threatens them. Being caught in commercial fisheries threatens them when they're out in the ocean. So there's really no place that they can go that they're safe unless we have some kind of protection measures in place.
So as you collect all of this DNA, and DNA can tell us a lot about any species, Joe, what else are you learning? Is there anything else that you're getting from all this DNA material that could either help or hinder?
Well, one of the things we're learning is we've always known, or we've known for a long time, that turtles tend to return to, when the turtle hatches, it goes into the ocean and pretty much circumvents the whole ocean basin for many years of its life. And then when it becomes reproductively mature at 25 or 30 years old, it returns to the beach where it hatched. So one of the big questions still is how do they find their way back after all those years and after all that distance? But what this has allowed us to fine-tune the scale that they return to the beach. So they may not return to the exact same beach they hatched on, but Georgia turtles are going to tend to return to Georgia somewhere to hatch. So it gives us an idea about how accurate their homing is back to their natal beaches. Tracking this DNA over years tells us how many years between nesting for individual females. Some females return in 2 or 3 years, some return in longer time periods, so they'll nest 1 year and we may not see them again for 4 or 5 years. And so this allows us to collect that data that we really couldn't collect before. And it also tells us what the reproductive output of individual turtles are, because once we have a female's DNA in our database, every time she lays a nest, we can assign that nest to that female.
That is UGA Conservation Genetics Professor Joe Nairn. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you very much.
Let's move out of the water and back onto dry land now. Atlanta may be an urban haven, but all the skyscrapers and traffic and walled dwellings can't keep the critters away. A couple of years ago, the National Wildlife Federation compiled a list of America's top 10 wildlife-friendly cities, and Atlanta came in third. That means if you live in the metro area, your yard may be sounding something like this, with spring nearly sprung. I don't know what that last thing is, but I think I heard a squirrel in there. Joining us today to talk about the wildlife-friendly ranking is Nataki Osborne-Jelk. She's the Manager of Education and Advocacy Programs for the National Wildlife Federation. Hi there.
Hello.
So tell me about how can a city kind of become a wildlife-friendly place, which is just all about how much greenery you have?
Absolutely. A city can become a wildlife-friendly place. We decided upon our rankings based on three different criteria. The first criteria is the amount of parkland available in the city. And the other measures really relate to citizen action. We looked at the number of wildlife habitats that people might have on their personal property in their backyards, and the number of schools who have committed to engage in learning in wildlife gardens. So people can go into their own backyards and provide sources of habitat. They can provide water, shelter, food, and places for wildlife to raise their young in their backyards, on balconies, on front porches, in small little plots. So we can all contribute to our cities becoming more wildlife friendly in that way.
How delicate is that balance, though? Because there are times when people don't appreciate living right next door to wildlife, and they're going to call the critter control to take away that opossum or that raccoon, or they don't want to have bees in the backyard stinging them. How delicate is that?
Well, it is a little bit delicate, but what I like to encourage people to do is to take those small steps. So perhaps you're not looking for kind of iconic wildlife species, but everybody likes to hear sort of the chirp of birds outside their window, or everybody likes to see beautiful butterflies. And so there are plants that we can plant. You know, milkweed, for instance, is a host plant for monarch butterflies, which are beautiful, and most people are in awe of them when they see them. So I like to really try to encourage people to look for those wildlife species that, you know, perhaps are, you know, non-threatening to them, but, you know, for which they would appreciate and not mind having around.
As opposed to the raccoon knocking your trash cans over. What are the common wildlife, what are the common creatures we have here in Atlanta?
Well, Atlanta, because of the green space, and we have significant green space resources. We have always been known as sort of the city in the forest, and I know we've gotten a bad reputation because of unchecked growth and development and sprawl. However, that has slowed a little bit because of, you know, the boom in the housing market and things like that. But we also have lots of groups who are working to restore critical wildlife habitat in the city. So in parts of the city, in West Atlanta where I live, we see wild turkey, foxes, deer, coyote, all of those types of things. But we're also working with a network of schools and organizations through an effort called the Greater Atlanta Pollinator Partnership. And these organizations are working to restore pollinator habitat, so habitat for hummingbirds and bees and butterflies, which, you know, also contribute to, you know, food production and those great things as well.
Okay, so we only have about a minute left, but if I want to make us more wildlife, maybe we want to bump Portland, Oregon off the list. Okay, let's say that's our goal. What do I plant back in my backyard? Milkweed, and what else do I?
Well, I think milkweed is one that's the host plant for the monarch butterfly. But there are also, you know, other native plant species that we can look to. And I think, you know, planting is kind of individual. People, you know what they like to see. And so looking for wildlife-friendly species that also meet our ideas for aesthetics, I think, is a good way to go. And you can find out more information by checking us out at www.nwf.org.
Right, because the opossum is not an attractive creature, actually. Anataki Osborne-Chokes is the manager of no offense to all the opossums out there listening. She is the manager of the education and advocacy programs for the National Wildlife Federation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. But we want to hear about your encounters with wildlife. So call us with your stories at 404-500-9457, or you can post on Facebook. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.